general store, a township office, a chapel, and a handful of shoddily erected houses, some half-constructed, as if their builders had lost interest. "Anybody here?" Michael yelled. "Hello?"
"Feels strange," Greer said.
Michael reached into the Humvee and released the shotgun from the holder. Peter and Greer checked their pistols.
"I'll stay with Amy," Greer said. "You two go find the telegraph station."
Peter and Michael crossed the square to the township office. The door stood open. Another oddity. Everything appeared normal inside, but still there were no signs of life.
"So where the hell did everybody go?" Peter said.
The telegraph was in a small room in the rear of the building. Michael sat at the operator's desk and examined the log, a large leather-bound ledger. "The last message from here was sent Friday, 5:20 p.m. to Bandera Station. The intended recipient was Mrs. Nils Grath."
"What was the message?"
"Happy birthday, Aunt Lottie." Michael looked up. "Nothing after that. At least that anybody bothered to record." Today was Sunday. Whatever had happened here, Peter thought, it had happened sometime in the last 48 hours.
"Send a message to Kerrville," Peter instructed. "Let Apgar know we're coming."
"My Morse is a little rusty. I'll probably tell him to make me a sandwich."
Michael threw a switch on the panel and began tapping the key. A few seconds later, he stopped.
"What's wrong?"
Michael pointed to the panel. "See this meter? The needle should move when the plates touch."
"So?"
"So I'm talking to myself here. The circuit won't close." Peter knew nothing about it.
"Is that something you can fix?"
"Not a chance. There's a break in the line. Could be anywhere between here and Kerrville. The storm might have knocked down a pole. A lightning strike could do it, too. It doesn't take much." They exited through the back door. An old gas generator was crouched like a monster in the weeds beside a rusted pickup and a buckboard with a broken axle and tall grass poking through the floorboards.
Trash of all kinds. Construction debris, busted packing crates, barrels with their seams split open littered the yard. The wreckage of the frontier. Flung out the door the moment it had outlived its usefulness.
"Let's check some of the other buildings," Peter said. They entered the nearest house. It was one story with two rooms. Dirty dishes were stacked on a table. Flies twisted above them in the air. In the back room was a wash basin on a stand, a wardrobe, and large feather bed covered by a quilt. The bed was sturdy and carefully made, with a tableau of interlocking flowers, quite detailed, carved into the headboard. Somebody had taken their time with it. A marriage bed, thought Peter.
But where were the people? What had happened that the inhabitants should vanish before they had a chance to clear the dirty dishes from the table?
Peter and Michael returned to the main room as Greer came through the door.
"What's the holdup?"
"The telegraph's not working," Michael said.
"What's wrong with it?"
"Break in the line someplace." Greer leveled his eyes at Peter.
"We really have to get moving."
What weren't they seeing? What was this haunted place trying to tell him?
Peter's eyes fell upon something on the floor.
"Peter, did you hear me?"
Greer pressed. "If we're going to make it back before dark, we need to leave right now." Peter crouched to get a closer look, simultaneously gesturing toward the table.
"Hand me that dish rag."
Using a corner of the cloth, he took hold of the object. The viral's teeth had a way of catching the light, almost prismatic, with a pearlescent, milky luster. The tip was so sharp it seemed to fade into invisibility, too small for the naked eye to discern.
"I don't think Zero's sending an army," Peter said.
"Then what's he doing?" Michael asked.
Peter looked at Greer. The older man's expression said he thought the same.
"I think he's growing one."
57. By the time the convoy reached Kerrville, it was nearly 7 o'clock.
The group disembarked into a state of siege. Along the top of the wall, soldiers were scurrying back and forth, handing out magazines and other gear. 50-caliber machine guns were positioned on either side of the gate. Apgar had exited the cab and was standing with Ford Chase, pointing at one of the spotlights. As Chase moved away, Caleb stepped up. "General, I'd like my commission back." Apgar frowned. "I have to say, that's a first. Nobody ever asks to get back in the army. You can bust me to private, I don't care." The general looked past Caleb's shoulder toward Pym, who was standing with Sarah and the children. "You clear this with your CO?" "I'd be lying if I said she was happy about it. But she gets it. She lost her sister last night." Apgar beckoned to a non-com manning the gates. "Sergeant, take this man to the armory and get him suited up. One brass bar." "Thank you, General," said Caleb. "You may rethink that later. And your old man's gonna have my ass for this." "Have we heard anything?" Apgar shook his head. "Try not to worry, son. He's been through worse than this. Report to Colonel Henneman on the platform. He'll tell you where to go." Caleb went to Pym and hugged her. He placed his palm against the curve of her belly, then kissed Theo on the forehead. "Be careful," she signed. "We're going to the hospital," Sarah said. "There's a hard box in the basement. We're moving the patients down there." The sergeant shifted impatiently on his feet. "Sir, we'd better go." Caleb looked at his family a final time. He felt a gap widening, as if he were viewing them from the end of a lengthening tunnel. "I love you," Pym signed. "I love you too." He jogged away. From Bernie, Greer took the wheel. They were driving into the sun now. Michael was in the passenger seat, Peter in the back with Amy. They saw no other vehicles, no signs of life at all. The world seemed dead, an alien landscape. The shadows of the hills were lengthening. Evening was coming on. Greer, squinting into the harsh light, wore a look of great intensity, his arms and back rigid as wood, his fingers clenching the wheel. Peter saw the muscles of his jaw bunching. The man was grinding his teeth. They passed through Comfort. The ruins of ancient buildings, restaurants, gas stations, hotels, lined the highway, sand scoured and scavenged to the bones. They came to the settlement on the west side of the city, away from the wreckage of the old world. Like Bernie, the town was abandoned. They didn't stop. 15 miles to go. Sarah and the others met Jenny at the door to the hospital. The woman was on the verge of wild-eyed panic.
"What's going on? There are soldiers everywhere. A Humvee just rolled by with a bullhorn telling everybody to take shelter."
"There's an attack coming. We have to get these people to the basement. How many patients are on the wards?"
"What do you mean, an attack?"
"I mean virals, Jenny."
The woman blanched, but said nothing.
"Listen to me."
Sarah took Jenny's hands and made the woman look at her.
"We don't have a lot of time here. How many?"
Jenny gave her head a little shake, as if trying to focus her thoughts.
15?
"Any children?"
"Just a couple. One boy has pneumonia. The other a broken wrist we just set. We've got one woman in labor, but she's early."
"Where's Hannah?"
Hannah was Jenny's daughter, a girl of 13. Her son was grown and gone. Jenny and her husband had long since parted ways.
"Home, I think?"
"Run and get her. I can handle the situation until you're back."
"God, Sarah.
Just be quick."
Jenny darted from the building. Pym, holding Thea, was standing with the girls. Sarah crouched before them.
"I need you to go with your Auntie Pym now."
Elle looked fearful and lost. Snot was running from her nose. Sarah wiped it with the bottom edge of her shirt.
"Where are we going?"
the girl asked woefully.
People were scurrying past. Nurses, doctors, orderlies with stretchers.
Sarah glanced up at Pym, then looked at her granddaughter again.
"Downstairs to the basement," Sarah answered. "You'll be safe there."
"I want to go home."
"It's just for a little while,"
She hugged Elle, then her sister. Pim led the girls to the stairs. As they descended, Sarah turned to her husband. She recognized the look on his face. It was the same one he'd worn the night after Bill had been killed, when he'd shown her the note.
"It's okay," she said.
"You're sure?"
"I've got things in hand here.
Go before I change my mind."
No more words were necessary. Hollis kissed her and strode out the door. They turned off Highway 10. From here, it was a straight shot south on a gravel road to the city. The truck shook fiercely as they pounded through the potholes. Wind whipped through the open windows. The sun, coming across their right shoulders, was low and bright.
"Michael, take the wheel and keep it steady." Greer reached below his seat. "Peter, give her this."
Peter leaned forward to receive the pistol. A round was already chambered.
"You won't have time to aim," he said to Amy. "Just point and shoot, like you're pointing your finger."
She took the gun from him. Her expression was uncertain, yet her grip seemed firm.
"You have 15 rounds. You'll have to be close. Don't try to shoot them from a distance."
"Unlock the shotgun," Greer said. Michael freed the weapon. An extended magazine tube ran below the barrel, holding 8 shells.
"What's in here?" he asked Greer.
"Slugs, big ones. No room for slop, but it'll put one down fast." The shape of the city emerged in the distance. Standing on the hill, it looked as small as a toy.
"This is going to be tight," Greer said.
The last patients were being brought down from the main floor. Jenny stood at the door of the hard box with a clipboard, checking names off a list, while Sarah and the nursing staff moved among the cots, doing their best to make sure everyone was comfortable. Sarah came to the cot that held the pregnant woman Jenny had spoken of. She was young, with thick, dark hair. While Sarah took her pulse, she looked quickly at the girl's chart. A nurse had checked her an hour ago. Her cervix had been barely dilated. Her name was Grace Alvado.
"Grace, I'm Dr. Wilson. Is this your first baby?"
"I was pregnant one other time, but it didn't take."
"And how old are you?"
21.
Sarah stopped. The age was right. If this was the same Grace, Sarah had last seen her when she was just a day old.
"Are your parents Carlos and Sally Jimenez? You knew my folks?"
Sarah almost smiled. She might have, on a different day.
"This might surprise you, Grace, but I was there the day you were born."
She looked toward the girl's companion, who was sitting on a packing crate on the other side of the cot. He was older, maybe 40, with a rough look to him, though like many new fathers, he seemed a little overwhelmed by the sudden urgency of events after months of waiting.
"Are you Mr. Alvado?"
"Call me Jock, everybody does."
"I need you to keep her relaxed, Jock. Deep breaths, and no pushing for now. Can you do that for me?"
"I'll try."
Jenny came up behind Sarah.
"Everybody's in," she said.
Sarah put her hand on Grace's arm.
"Just focus on having your baby, okay?"
The basement door was made of heavy steel, set into walls of thick concrete. Sarah was about to close it when the room plunged into darkness. An anxious murmuring, and then people began to shout.
"Everybody, settle down, please," Sarah said.
"What happened to the lights?"
a voice cried from the darkness.
"The army's just diverting current to the spots, that's all."
"That means the virals are coming."
"We don't know that. Everyone just try to keep calm."
Jenny was standing beside her.
"Is that really what they're doing?" she asked quietly.
"Do I know?
Go check the storage room for lanterns and candles."
The woman returned a couple of minutes later. Lamps were lit and distributed around the space. The yells had fallen to whispers, and then, in the gloom, a tense silence.
"Jenny, give me a hand."
The door weighed 400 pounds. Sarah and Jenny pulled it closed and turned the wheel to engage the bolts. A quarter of Apgar's men had taken up positions within 500 yards of the gate.
The rest were spread at regular intervals along the walls and connected by radio. Caleb was in charge of a squad of 12 men. 6 of them had been stationed at Luckenbach, part of a small contingent who'd made it to a hard box as the garrison was overrun. No officers had survived, orphaning them in the chain of command. Now they were Caleb's. A man came banging down the catwalk toward him. Hollis wore no uniform, but a standard-issue chest pack was cinched to his frame, holding 6 spare magazines and a long sheathed knife. An M4 dangled from its sling across his broad frame, the muzzle pointed downward. A pistol was holstered to his thigh. He gave a crisp salute.
"Private Wilson, sir."
It was absurd, Hollis speaking to him this way. He almost seemed like he was play-acting. "You're kidding me."
"The women and children are secure. I was told to report to you."
His face was set in a way that Caleb had never seen before. This large, gentle man, collector of books and reader to children, had become a warrior.
"I made a promise, Lieutenant," Hollis reminded him. "I believe you were there at the time."
The spots came on, spilling a defensive perimeter of stark white light at the base of the wall. Radios began to crackle. A tremor of energy moved up and down the catwalk. A call went out.
"Eyes up!"
The clack of chambering rounds. Caleb pointed his rifle over the wall and flicked off the safety. He glanced to his right, where Hollis stood at the ready, feet wide, stock set, eyes trained down the barrel in perfect alignment. His body was somehow both tense and relaxed, purposeful and at ease with itself. It had the look of an old feeling stitched to the bones, summoned effortlessly to the surface when called upon. Where would the virals come from? How many would there be? His chest was opening and closing arrhythmically. His vision seemed unnaturally confined. He forced himself to take a long, deep breath. "Don't think," he told himself. "There are times for thinking, but this isn't one of them." A glowing point appeared in the distance, straight north. Adrenaline hit his heart. He hardened the stock against his shoulder. The light began to bob, then to separate like a dividing cell. Not virals. Headlights.
"Contact!" a voice yelled. 30 degrees right! 200 yards! Contact! 20 left!
For the first time in over 2 decades, the horn began to wail. Greer shoved the accelerator to the floor. The speedometer leapt, the fields flying past in a blur, the engine roaring, the frame of the truck shuddering.
"They're dead behind us," Michael yelled.
Peter swiveled in his seat. Points of light were rising from the fields.
"Look out!"
Greer yelled. Peter turned around in time to see 3 virals leap into the headlights. Greer took aim and sliced through the pod. As bodies barreled over the hood, Peter slammed forward and bounced back into his seat. When he looked again, a single viral was clinging to the hood of the truck. Michael pointed the shotgun over the dash and fired. The glass exploded. Greer swerved to the left. Peter was thrown against the door, Amy on top of him. They were barreling through a bean field, moving laterally to the gate. Greer swerved the opposite way. The chassis tipped to the left, threatened to roll. Then the wheels slammed down. Greer crested a rise and the truck went briefly airborne before spinning back onto the road. An ominous clunk from below. They began to decelerate. Peter yelled to Greer,
"What's wrong?"
Smoke was pouring from the grill. The engine roared pointlessly.
"We must have hit something. The transmission's blown. On your right!"
Peter turned, took the viral in his sights, and squeezed the trigger, missing cleanly. Again and again he fired. He had no idea if he was hitting anything. The slide locked back. The magazine was empty. The lighted perimeter was still 100 yards away.
"I'm out!" Michael yelled.
As the truck floated to a halt, flares arced from the catwalk, dragging contrails of light and smoke above their heads. Peter turned to Amy. She was slumped against the door, the pistol, unfired, dangling in her hand.
"Greer," Peter said, "help me."
He pulled her from the cab. Her motions were as heavy and loose as a sleepwalker's. The flares began their lazy, flickering descents. As Amy's legs unfolded from the truck, Greer stepped around the front of the vehicle, shoving fresh shells into the shotgun's magazine. He slapped the gun into Peter's hand and slid his right shoulder under Amy's arm to take her weight. "Cover us," he said. Caleb helplessly watched the truck's approach. The virals were still well out of reach for even the luckiest shot. Up and down the wall, voices were yelling to hold fire, to wait until they were in range. He saw the truck stop. Four figures emerged. At the rear of the group, one man turned and fired a shotgun into the heart of an approaching pod. One shot, two shots, three, flames blooming from the gun's muzzle in the darkness. Caleb knew that man to be his father. He had stepped into the harness and clipped in before he was even aware he was doing it. The action was automatic. He had no plan, only instinct. "Caleb, what the hell are you doing?" Hollis was staring at him. Caleb hopped to the top of the rampart and turned his back toward the fields. "Tell Apgar we'll need a squad at the pedestrian portal. Go." Before Hollis could say anything else, Caleb pushed off. A long arc away from the wall, and his boots touched concrete. He shoved himself away again. Two more pushes, and he landed in the dirt. He unclipped and swung his rifle around. His father was running with the others up the hill, just inside the lighted perimeter. Virals were massing at the edges. Some were covering their eyes. Others had crouched into low, ball-like shapes. A moment's hesitation, their instincts warring inside them. Would the lights be enough to hold them back? The virals charged. The machine guns opened up. Caleb ducked reflexively as bullets whizzed over his head, slicing into the creatures with a wet, slapping sound. Blood splashed. Flesh was cleaved from bone. Whole pieces of the virals' bodies winged away. They seemed not merely to die, but to disintegrate. The machine guns pounded round after round. A slaughter. Yet always there were more, surging into the lights. "The portal!" Caleb called. He was running forward at a 45-degree angle to the wall, waving above his head. "Head for the portal!" Caleb dropped to one knee and began to fire. Did his father see him? Did he know who he was? The bolt locked back. 30 rounds, gone in a heartbeat. He dropped the magazine, reached into his chest pack for a fresh one, and shoved it into the receiver. Something crashed into him from behind. Breath, sight, thought, all left him. He felt himself sailing, almost hovering. This seemed extraordinary. In the midst of his flight, he had just enough time to marvel at the lightness of his body compared to other things. Then his body grew heavy again and he slammed into the ground. He was rolling down the incline, his rifle whipping around on its sling. He tried to control his body, its wild tumble down the hill. His hand found the lower unit of the rifle, but his index finger got tangled in the trigger guard. He rolled again onto his chest, the rifle wedged between his body and the ground, and there was no stopping it. The gun went off. Pain. He came to rest on his back, the rifle lying over his chest. Had he shot himself? The ground was spinning under him. It refused to be still. He blinked into the spotlights. He didn't feel the way he imagined a shot person would. The pain was in two places. His chest, which had received the explosive force of the rifle's firing, and a spot on his forehead, near the outer edge of his right eyebrow. He reached up, expecting blood. His fingers came away dry. He understood what had happened. The ejecting cartridge, ricocheting off the ground, had pinged upward into his face, narrowly missing his eye. "You are fucking lucky, Caleb Jackson," he thought. "I really hope nobody saw that." A shadow fell across him. Caleb raised the rifle, but as his left hand reached forward to balance the barrel, he realized the mag well was empty. The magazine had been stripped away. He had, at various times of his life, imagined the moment of his own death. These imaginings had not included lying on his back with an empty rifle while a viral tore him to pieces.
Perhaps, he considered, that's the way it was for everybody. Bet you didn't think of this.
Caleb dropped the rifle. His only hope was his sidearm. Had he racked it? Had he remembered to free the safety? Would the gun even be there, or had it, like the rifle's magazine, been stripped from his person? The shadow had taken the form of a human silhouette, but it wasn't human. Not at all. The head cocked, the claws extended, the lips retreated, revealing a dark cave dripping with teeth. The pistol was in Caleb's hand, and rising. A burst of blood. The creature curled around the hole at the center of its chest. With an almost tender gesture, it reached up with one clawed hand and touched the wound. It raised its face with a bland expression. Am I dead? Did you do that? But Caleb hadn't. He hadn't even pulled the trigger. The shot had come from over Caleb's shoulder. For a second, they studied one another, Caleb and this dying thing. Then a second figure stepped from Caleb's right, shoved the muzzle of a shotgun into the viral's face, and fired. It was his father. With him was a woman, barefoot, in a plain frock, the kind the sisters wore. Her hair was the barest patina of darkness on her skull. In her outstretched hand, she held the pistol she had used to fire the first fatal shot. Amy.
Peter,
she said, and melted to her knees. Then they were running. No words were passed that Caleb would later recall. His father was carrying Amy over his shoulder. Two other men were with them. One of them had the shotgun his father had cast aside. The portal was open. A squad of six soldiers had formed a firing line in front of it.
Get down!
The voice was Hollis's. All of them hit the dirt. Shots screamed past them, then ceased abruptly. Caleb lifted his face. Over the barrel of his rifle, Hollis was waving them on.
Run your asses off!
His father and Amy entered first, Caleb following. A barrage of gunfire erupted behind them. The soldiers were shouting to one another,
On your left! On your right! Go! Go!
Firing their rifles as one by one, they backed through the narrow doorway. Hollis was the last to enter. He dropped his rifle, swung the door around, and began to close it, clutching the wheel that, once turned, would set the bolts. Just as the lip of the door was about to make contact with the frame, it stopped.
Need some help here?
Hollis was bracing the door with his shoulder. Caleb sprang forward and pushed. Others did the same. Still, the gap began to widen. An inch, then two more. Half a dozen men were piled against the door. Caleb swiveled his body so his back was braced against it and dug the heels of his boots into the earth. But the end was ordained. Even if they could hold the door a few minutes longer, the viral's strength would outlast them. He saw a way. Caleb dropped his hand to his belt. He hated grenades. He could not put aside the irrational fear that they would detonate of their own accord. Thus, it was with some psychological effort that he freed one from his belt and pulled the pin. Holding the striker lever in place, he angled his face to the edge of the door. He needed more space. The gap between the door and its frame was too narrow. Nobody was going to like what he was about to do, but he had no time to explain. He stepped back. The door lurched inward 6 inches. A hand appeared at the edge, clawed fingers curling with a searching gesture around the lip. A chorus of yells erupted.
What are you doing? Push the goddamn door!
Caleb relaxed his grip on the grenade, freeing the striker lever.
Catch,
he said, and shoved it through the opening. He thrust his shoulder against the door. Eyes closed, he counted off the seconds like a prayer. One Mississippi, two Mississippi, three Mississippi. A boom. The ping of shrapnel. Dust falling. 58.
We need a corpsman over here right now!
Peter lowered Amy to the ground. Her lips moved haltingly. Then she asked, very softly,
Are we inside?
Everyone's safe. Her skin was pale, her eyes heavy-lidded.
I'm sorry. I thought I could make it on my own.
Peter looked up. Where's my son? Caleb!
Right here, Dad.
His boy was standing behind him. Peter rose and drew him into a fierce hug.
What the hell were you doing out there?
Coming to get you. There were scratches on his arms and face. One of his elbows was bleeding.
What about Pim and Theo?
Peter couldn't help it. He was talking in bursts. They're safe. We got here a few hours ago. Peter was suddenly overcome. Thoughts crowded his mind from all directions. He was exhausted. He needed water. The city was under attack. His son and his family were safe. Two medics appeared with a stretcher. Greer and Michael lifted Amy onto it.
I'll go with her to the aid station, Greer said.
No, I'll do it.
Greer took his arm above the elbow and looked at him squarely. She'll be fine, Peter. We did it. Just go do your job. They bore her away. Peter looked up to see Apgar and Chase striding toward him. Above them, the gunfire had fallen to random spattering.
Mr. President, said Apgar, I would appreciate it if in the future you did not cut it quite so close.
What's our status?
The attack appears to have come only from the north. We've got no sightings elsewhere on the wall.
What do we hear from the townships?
Apgar hesitated.
Nothing.
What do you mean, nothing?
Everybody's off the air. We ran patrols this morning as far west as Hunt, south to Bandera, and as far north as Fredericksburg. No survivors, and almost no bodies. At this point, we have to assume they've all been overrun.
Peter had no words. Over 200,000 people. Gone.
Mr. President?
Apgar was looking at him. Peter swallowed and said,
How many people do we have inside the wall?
Including military. 4, maybe 5,000 tops. Not a lot to fight with.
What about the Isthmus? Michael asked the general.
As a matter of fact, we got a call on the radio from them a couple of hours ago. Someone named Lore, wondering where you were. They didn't know anything about last night's attack, so I guess the Drax missed them. That, or they were too smart to try to cross that causeway.
Above them, the guns fell silent.
Maybe that's it for tonight, Chase said.
He scanned their faces hopefully.
Maybe we scared them off.
Peter didn't think so. He could tell that Apgar didn't think so either.
We need to make some decisions, Peter, Michael cut in. The window's closing fast. We should be talking about getting people out of here.
The idea suddenly seemed absurd.
I'm not leaving these people undefended, Michael. This thing has started. Right now, I need everybody who can hold a pitchfork on that wall.
You're making a mistake.
From the catwalk.
Contact! 2,000 yards!
The first thing they saw was a line of light in the distance.
Soldier, give me your binoculars.
The spotter handed them over. Peter brought the lenses to his eyes. Standing beside him on the platform, Apgar and Michael were also scanning north.
Can you tell how many there are?
Peter asked the general.
They're too far out to tell.
Apgar unclipped the walkie on his belt and brought it to his mouth.
All stations, what are you seeing?
A crackle of static, then,
Station 1, negative. Station 2, no contact. Station 3, same here. We're not seeing anything.
And so on, around the perimeter. The line of light began to stretch, though it appeared to come no closer.
What the hell are they doing? Apgar said. They're just waiting out there.
Hang on.
Michael pointed. 30 degrees left. Peter followed his aim. A second line was forming.
There's another, Apgar said. 40 right, near the tree line. Looks like a large pod. More coming in from the north, too.
The main line was now several hundred yards long. Virals were streaming in from all directions, moving toward the central mass.
This is no scouting party, Peter said.
Apgar bellowed, Runners, get ready to move!
He turned to Peter.
Mr. President, we need to get you to safety.
Peter addressed one of the spotters. Corporal, hand me that M16.
Peter, please. This is not a good idea.
The soldier passed Peter the weapon. He freed the magazine, blew on the top round to clear any dust, reseated it in the well, and pulled the charging handle.
You know, Gunner, I think that's the first time in 10 years you've called me by my first name.
The conversation ended there. A low rumbling sound rolled toward them. With each second, it increased in intensity.
What am I hearing? Michael said.
It was the sound of feet striking the earth. The mass continued to thicken, its great heaving volume barreled toward them. In its wake, a cloud of dust boiled high in the air.
Holy God, Peter said. It's everyone.
Apgar lifted his voice over the din.
Hold fire till they reach the perimeter!
The horde was 300 yards out and closing fast. It seemed less like an army than some great spectacle of nature. An avalanche, a hurricane, a flood. The platform began to hum, its bolts and rivets vibrating in rhythm to the seismic impact of the viral's charge.
Will that gate hold? Peter asked Apgar.
He, too, had given up his binoculars for a rifle.
Against this?
200 yards. Peter pressed the stock of the weapon against his clavicle.
Ready!
Apgar bellowed. 100 yards.
Aim!
Everything stopped. The virals had halted just beyond the edge of the lights. Not just halted. They were frozen in place, as if a switch had been thrown.
What the hell?
The mass began to divide into halves, creating a corridor. Starting at the rear, it flowed down the middle with a rippling on either side. The motion seemed somehow reverential, as if the virals were making way for a great king to pass among them, bowing as he passed. A dark shape was pushing forward through the heart of the horde. It appeared to be some sort of animal. It approached the city with painstaking slowness, the corridor unfurling before it. All guns were trained on the spot where it would emerge. 100 feet, 50, 20. The front wall of virals separated, opening like a doorway to reveal the shockingly ordinary figure of a person on horseback.
Is that him? Apgar said. Is that Zero?
The rider moved forward into the lights. Halfway to the gate, he brought his horse to a halt and dismounted. Not he, Peter realized. She. The glare of the spotlights ricocheted off the lenses of the dark glasses that obscured the upper half of her face. A scabbard containing some kind of weapon, a sword or long gun, lay slantwise across her back. Crisscrossing her upper body, she wore a pair of bandoliers.
Bandoliers. Holy goddamn, Michael breathed.
Peter's mind was tumbling down a hole in time.
Hold your fire!
He raised his arms high and wide above his head.
Everyone stand down!
Her back erect, the woman angled her face toward the top of the wall.
I am Alicia Donadio, captain of the expeditionary. Where is Peter Jackson?
59. 30 minutes had passed. Everyone was in position. Standing back from the portal, Peter nodded at Henneman. Open it, Colonel. Henneman turned the wheel and backed away. From inside the tunnel came a slow clop of hooves. A frisson of energy rippled through the line of soldiers facing the portal. All guns were raised. All eyes arrowed over the barrels. A shadow elongated across the wall of the tunnel. Then Alicia emerged. One hand held a short rope attached to the horse's bridle. The second lay easily at her side. Her hair, that distinctive red crown, was pulled tight to her scalp, its length corralled into a densely woven braid that fell midway down her back. On her upper body she wore a t-shirt without sleeves, revealing the muscularity of her arms and shoulders. Below, loose trousers cinched at the waist, and a pair of leather boots. A quick scan of the crowd,
the lights of the staging area rebounding off the lenses of her goggles like search beams. Another step forward, and there she paused, awaiting instructions. "Move forward," Peter said, slowly. She advanced another 20 feet. Peter ordered her to stop. "Blades first. Toss them forward."
"That's all you have to say?"
He had a sudden feeling of unreality. It was as if he were talking to a ghost. "The blades, Lish." She glanced to Peter's right.
"Michael, I didn't notice you standing there."
"Hello, Lish." "And Colonel Apgar." Alicia gave a quick nod from the chin.
"It's nice to see you, sir."
"It's general to you, Donadio." The man's arms were folded over his chest. His face was a hard scowl. "Mr. President, say the word and this is done."
"Mr. President?"
From Alicia, a wry frown.
"You've come up in the world, Peter."
The old banter, the jokey tone. Was it a trick? "I said, take them off." In a manner that struck him as leisurely, Alicia unbuckled the straps and tossed her bandoliers to the ground. "Now the sword," Peter said.
"I'm here to talk, that's all."
Peter lifted his voice toward the top of the wall. "Snipers, target the horse!" Then to Alicia.
"Soldier, isn't it?"
If he'd rattled her, she didn't show it. Nevertheless, she drew the scabbard over her head and lumped it forward. "Now the goggles," Peter said.
"I'm no threat, Peter. I'm just the messenger."
He waited.
"As you like."
Off they came, revealing her eyes. Their orange color had grown stronger, more piercing. Time had not moved for her. She hadn't aged a day. Yet something was different, a quality not so much seen as felt, like the prickling of a storm's approach long before the clouds arrived. Her gaze did not wander, but held him straight. A look of challenge, though now that her face was unconcealed, there was something naked about her, almost vulnerable. Her confidence was a ruse. Feelings of uncertainty lay beneath. "Hit the lights!" Three portable banks of sodium vapor lamps were positioned behind him. They went off like a gun, blasting Alicia in the face. As her hands flew upward, half a dozen soldiers charged forward and shoved her face first to the ground. With a loud whinny, Soldier reared up on his hind legs and pawed violently at the air. One of the soldiers jammed the barrel of a pistol against the base of Alicia's skull, while the others covered her body. "Somebody control that animal," Peter barked. "If it makes any trouble, shoot it."
"Leave him alone."
"Colonel Henneman, shackle the prisoner." As two soldiers led the horse away, Henneman holstered his pistol, stepped forward, and chained Alicia's wrists and ankles. A third chain connected the shackles behind her back. "Rise and face me," Peter said. Alicia rocked upright into a kneeling position. Her eyes were clamped shut, her face angled down and away from the harsh glare of the lights, like someone dodging a blow.
"I'm trying to save your lives, Peter."
"You have an interesting way of showing it.
You need to hear what I have to say."
"So talk." A moment passed. Then she began.
"There's a man. More than a man. A kind of viral, but he looks like us. His name is Fanning. He's in New York City, in a building called Grand Central. He's the one who sent me."
"So that's where you've been all this time?" Alicia nodded.
"There are things I never told you, Peter. Things I couldn't tell you. The viral part of me was always stronger than I let on. The feeling got worse and worse. I knew I couldn't control it for long.
Right after Iowa, I began to hear Fanning in my head. That's why I went to New York. I intended to kill him. Or he could kill me. I didn't really care which. I just wanted it all to be over."
"So why didn't you?" "Believe me, I wanted to.
I wanted to slice his damn head off. But I couldn't. The viral that bit me in Colorado wasn't Babcock's. It was Fanning's. It's his virus I carry. I belong to him, Peter. I belong to him. The phrase was chilling. Peter glanced at Apgar to see if the full meaning had registered. It had. Fanning and I had a deal. If I stayed with him, he'd leave you alone. Looks like he changed his mind. She shook her head emphatically. I didn't have any part in that. By the time I figured out what he was doing, it was too late to stop it. All along, he was waiting for you to spread out, your defenses to drop. It's Amy he wants. If I bring her to him, he'll call it off. So there it was. What does he want with her? I don't know. Don't you lie to me. Where is she, Peter? I have no idea. Nobody's seen Amy in over 20 years. Alicia's tone had shifted. All her bluster was gone. Listen to me, please. There's no stopping this. You've seen what he can do. He's not like the others. The others were nothing. We have walls. We have lights. We've fought them before. Go back and tell him that.
Peter, you don't get it. He doesn't have to do anything. You have what? Just a few thousand soldiers? And how much food? How much gas? Give him what he wants. It's your only chance.
Private Wilson, step forward, please. Hollis moved into the lights. You remember Hollis, don't you, Lish? Why don't you say hello? Her head was bowed.
Why do you even ask me that?
How about his daughter, Kate? She would have been a little girl the last time you saw her. Alicia nodded. Say it. Say you remember Kate.
Yes, I remember her.
I'm glad you do. She grew up to be a doctor, just like her mother. Two little girls of her own. Then one of your friends bit her last night. Want to know what happened next? Alicia was silent.
Do you? Just get on with it, Peter.
All right, I will. That little girl you remember? She shot herself. Her silence infuriated him.
What had happened to her? What had she become?
You don't have anything to say for yourself?
What do you want me to say? That I'm sorry?
You can do what you want with me, but that won't stop a thing. Peter's pulse was pounding. His hands were clenched. He jabbed a finger at her.
Look at him. I'll get Sarah out here. Kate's daughters, too. You can tell all of them how fucking sorry you are.
Alicia said nothing.
200,000 people, Lish. And you come here and talk about surrender? Like he's your friend?
Her shoulders shook. Was she crying? I'll ask you again. What does Fanning want with Amy? Her head rocked from side to side.
I don't know.
Gunner, give me your sidearm. Apgar drew his pistol, spun it in his hand, and passed it to Peter. Peter released the magazine, checked it, and shoved it back into the well, making a loud show of it. Michael said, Peter, what the hell are you doing? This woman is a viral. She's in league with the enemy.
It's Alicia. She's one of us.
Peter strode forward and leveled the barrel at Alicia's temple.
Tell me, goddammit.
I know she's here, Alicia murmured. I can hear it in your voice. He thumbed back the hammer and spoke through gritted teeth. He was running on instinct now, a blind white fury obliterating all thought. Answer the question, or I'm going to put a bullet through your head.
Wait,
He turned. Amy, clutching Greer's arm for balance, was standing at the edge of the circle.
Lucius, get her the hell out of here.
Two soldiers moved to block their path. One pressed a hand against Greer's chest. The man tensed, then, apparently changing his mind, permitted this.
Let me talk to her,
Amy said.
The idea was ludicrous. The woman could barely stand. A puff of wind would have knocked her to her knees.
I mean it, Greer.
I understand you're angry,
Amy said, but there's more to this than you know. She spoke to him as one might address a dangerous animal, or a man poised at the lip of an abyss. Peter was suddenly conscious of the pistol's slick weight in his hand.
Lucius can stay where he is, Amy said. But if you want answers, you need to let me through.
Peter looked back at Alicia. The woman's head hung in submission. She seemed small, frail, broken. Had he really been about to shoot her? This seemed impossible. Yet in the moment, something had taken him over, beyond his control.
Please, Peter.
The moment stretched. Everyone was staring.
All right, he said. Let her pass.
The soldiers stepped back. Amy's shadow lay long on the ground as she approached Alicia's cowed figure. Using her body to shield Alicia's face from the light, Amy crouched before her.
Hello, sister. It's good to see you. I'm sorry, Amy.
Her shoulders shook.
I'm so sorry. Don't be.
Tenderly, Amy lifted Alicia's chin with the tips of her fingers.
Do you know how proud I am of you? You've been so very strong.
Tears were coursing down Alicia's cheeks, cutting bright streaks in the dirt.
How can you say that to me?
Amy smiled into her face.
Because we're sisters. Isn't that so? Sisters in blood. My thoughts have never been far from you, you know.
Alicia said nothing.
He comforted you, didn't he?
Her lips were wet, tears rolling off her chin.
Yes. He took you in, cared for you. He made you feel that you were not alone.
Alicia's voice was barely more than a whisper.
Yes. Do you see? That's why I'm so proud of you. Because you didn't give in. Not in your heart.
But I did.
No, sister. I know what it's like to be alone, to be outside the walls. But that's over now.
Without breaking Alicia's gaze, Amy lifted her voice to the assembly.
Everyone, are you listening? You can put your guns down. This woman is a friend.
Hold your positions, Peter commanded. Amy swiveled her face toward him.
Peter, didn't you hear me? She's with us.
I need you to step away from the prisoner. In confusion, Amy looked back at Alicia, then at Peter once more.
It's okay, Alicia said. Do as he says. Lish, he's only doing what he has to. You really need to back away now.
An uncertain moment passed. Amy got to her feet. Another pause, her expression tentative, and she backed away. Alicia dropped her head. Peter said, Colonel, go ahead. Henneman approached Alicia from behind. He had donned a pair of heavy rubber gloves. In his hands was a metal rod wrapped with copper wire, one end connected by a long cord to the generator powering the lights. As the tip of the rod made contact with the base of Alicia's neck, she jerked upright, her shoulders pulled back and her chest thrust forward as if she'd been impaled. She made no sound at all. For a few seconds she stayed that way, every muscle taut as wire. Then the air let out of her, and she toppled face first into the dirt. Is she out?
Henneman nudged Alicia's ribs with the toe of his boot.
Looks like it.
Peter, why?
I'm sorry, Amy, but I can't trust her.
A truck was backing toward them. Two men jumped down from the cargo bay and dropped the tailgate.
All right, gentlemen, Peter said. Let's haul this woman to the stockade. And watch yourselves. You don't want to forget what she is.
60. 0530. Peter stood with Apgar on the catwalk, watching the day come on. An hour before dawn, the horde had departed. A vast, silent retreat, like a wave beating back from shore to enfold itself in the dark bulk of the sea. All that remained was a wide swath of trampled earth, and beyond, fields of broken corn.
I guess that's it for the night, Apgar said.
His voice was heavy, resigned. They waited, not talking, each man alone in his thoughts. A few minutes went by, and then the horn blasted, an expansion of sound like a great intake of breath, followed by the inevitable exhalation, sighing over the valley, then gone. Across the city, frightened people would be emerging from basements and shelters, out of closets and from under their beds. Old people, neighbors, families with children. They would look at each other wide-eyed and weary. Is it over? Are we safe?
You should get some sleep, Apgar said.
So should you.
Yet neither man moved. Peter's stomach was sour and empty. He couldn't remember when he'd eaten last, while the rest of him seemed numb, almost weightless. His face felt tight, like paper. The body's demands. The world could end, yet you'd still have to take a piss.
You know, Apgar said, and yawned into his fist. I think Chase was onto something. Maybe we should leave this to the kids to sort out.
It's an interesting idea. So, would you have actually shot her? The question had plagued him all night.
I don't know.
Well, don't beat yourself up. I wouldn't have had a problem with it.
A pause, then. Donadio was right about one thing. Even if we manage to hold them back, we don't have the gas to keep the lights burning for more than a few nights.
Peter stepped to the rampart. A gray morning, the light indifferent and worn. It seemed suitable.
I let this happen.
We all did.
No, this is on me. We never should have opened those gates.
What were you going to do? You can't keep people locked up forever.
You're not letting me off the hook here.
I'm just pointing out the reality. You want to blame someone? Blame Vicky. Hell, blame me. The decision to open the townships was made long before you came along. I'm the one in that chair, Gunner. I could have stopped it. And had a revolution on your hands. Once the Drax disappeared, this was a done deal. I'm surprised we kept this place running as long as we did.
No matter what Gunner said, Peter knew the truth. He'd let down his guard, allowing himself to believe that it was all in the past. The war, the virals, the old way of doing things. And now 200,000 people were gone.
Henneman and Chase came clumping down the catwalk. Chase looked like he'd slept under a bridge somewhere, but Henneman, always a stickler for appearance, had somehow managed to get through the night with barely a hair out of place.
Orders, General? The colonel asked.
It was not the time to drop their defenses, but the men needed rest. Apgar put them on a 4-hour rotation, 1/3 on the wall, 1/3 patrolling the perimeter, 1/3 in their racks.
So what now? Chase asked, as Henneman moved away.
But Peter had ceased listening. An idea was forming at the back of his mind.
Something old. Something from the past.
Mr. President? Peter turned to face the two men, Gunner, what are our weak points, besides the gate?
Apgar thought for a moment. The walls are sound. The dam's basically impregnable.
So